The meeting will come to order. There is a quorum present. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes for January 21st, 2015?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Representative Considine moves to approve the minutes for January 21st, 2015. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes of January 21st, 2015 are approved. Chair Schumacher, would you like to move your bill, House File 316, to get it before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House File 316 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform.
We have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill, or would you like to move the amendments?
I will start by discussing the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And before I begin this morning, committee members, I apologize that Representative Tyson and I did not hear that we were supposed to wear seafoam green today, as everyone else at the front table did this morning. I'm proud this morning to be carrying House File 316, which is a bill today to reform the way we provide senior care and the way we fund senior care in Minnesota. As lawmakers, we need to ensure that Minnesota is a great place to live and raise a family and start a business, but we also need to ensure that this is a great state that supports aging Minnesotans as our seniors in quality care and the needs that they have as they grow older. We've learned in our first hearing that we have about 60,000 Minnesotans that will turn 65 this year and every year thereafter for about the next 20 years. In just a few short years, there'll be more seniors in Minnesota than there will be school children, and the rate of growth and demand that we need demands that we have reform today and that we're able to provide that care in the communities later on. Last week we heard testimony about our current rate system in the state and how it was developed in the early 90s and has been a patchwork since then to make fixes and adjustments from that time, and that's been well over 20 years ago since we've really evaluated this. And the way that we look at senior care and the way that we deliver senior care has changed quite dramatically in that time, and our rate system hasn't caught up with it. We also heard from providers last week from across the state who described the system as not being prepared to meet the needs and the growing needs of our seniors throughout the state. We heard that people are not entering the field of caregiving because they can make more money at a Fleet Farm or a Dairy Queen or a sugar beet plant. We heard from a nursing home that actually closed beds and sent seniors to another state for care because they cannot find and hire the staff. And we heard about a care center that had more than 200 open shifts in 1 month because of lack of staff. House File 316 is a step in the right direction as it realigns our payment system with the actual cost of care, rewards efficiencies and quality improvements in the system, and will improve the wages and benefits of caregivers. I'm proud to have bipartisan support for this bill, and I think we can all agree that this is an issue that must be addressed as we move forward this year. With me today, we have representatives from the Long-Term Care Imperative to further explain the bill. But this would be a great time to take my amendments, Madam Chair.
Yes, it would. So Chair Schumacher has an author's amendment, A1-1. Representative Schumacher offers the author's amendment, A1-1. Does everyone have the amendment? Chair Schumacher, could you explain the amendment, please?
This is just a conformity amendment to meet with the language that the Senate had and to clean up some technical changes.
Any discussion? Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just do you want to, since this is an author's amendment, I don't know if Chair Schumacher wanted to adopt it before we discuss the amendment, but I do have a concern about it, or at least a question. So is this the right time for that?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, one of the things that's on this amendment is as I'm understanding the amendment, it's defining, or at least one part of it is defining what is meant by employer health insurance costs. And it's including this employer shared responsibility payments under the Federal Affordable Care Act. So what I understand that to be, and I'm looking for correction if I'm wrong, is under the Affordable Care Act, if employers do not provide affordable health care, or at least employers of a certain size, I think it's 50 employees, don't provide affordable health care coverage to their employees, and affordable is defined under the law, that they then have to pay a penalty, I think a tax penalty, I'm not exactly sure. But what I wonder about this is that in the bill, we are raising rates and we are covering, doing it on a cost basis. So the bill is actually covering health care costs for the employers, and I presume making it possible for them to offer their employees health coverage, which of course is one of the things that helps an employer keep an employee. If they're not offering health coverage, obviously their employees are going to look for other places to work. So given all of that, why would the state compensate an employer who is not providing what they should be providing under the law? I don't understand that. It's like, you know, if we lower the speed limit and somebody gets a speeding ticket, why would the state pay for the speeding ticket? So am I misunderstanding this, or why indeed would we be doing this?
Ms. Thurlow, welcome to the committee, and tell us who you are for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Alternative. Representative Liebling, to your question, the provision with regard to one of the goals of this bill is to help nursing homes cover and provide health insurance costs, especially in light of the new requirements under the Affordable Care Act. We've broadly defined and the strategies which nursing homes can do that under this bill. So you can see that one of them is the shared responsibility payments. There's also group coverage, reinsurance, actual expenses for self-insurance. It's sort of broadly defined to provide flexibility for nursing homes to decide which is best going to meet their needs. The analysis is, for many, group insurance or providing insurance through the employer is going to work. For others, allowing their employees to shop on the exchange and covering paying the shared responsibility payments to cover those subsidies for their employees is a more affordable option. And so just allowing, recognizing those payments as a possible strategy is one of the reasons why it's been broadly defined. As a general rule, we're saying that because this is now a requirement of our employers, it should be a cost that should be covered under this new payment structure. So we are broadly defining any of those costs that could be incurred by the employer.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Thurlow, so if an employer is choosing that option, what they're essentially doing is shifting even more of their costs to the taxpayer. And this is a situation where we, in this bill, are trying to enable nursing homes to pay for the costs of their employees. And I think it's really, I don't know what word to use, I think it's troubling, I guess, that we would also want to pay for allowing them to shift their responsibilities, more responsibility to the taxpayer as an option. So, Madam Chair, I would... Well, I guess I would move an amendment to the amendment to strike that portion of the language. So I would move to strike on line 1.6, starting with the word employer, all the way onto 1.7 through the end of the number there on the line. So the portion that refers to these employer shared responsibility payments. Because hopefully we are providing enough funding in this bill that everybody can comply and they can choose the option of providing health care for their employees, and then that actually gets baked into their cost structure under this bill.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. We'd like to take a 5-minute recess just to discuss this. And we will come back at 8:30. We will call the meeting back to order. Chair Schumacher?
Yeah, I'm open to that amendment and would like to incorporate it into the A1-1.
Ms. Pinelli, will you please tell us what it'll look like with the oral amendment in?
Madam Chair and members, the amendment is to the A1-1 amendment, and it would be deleting everything on line 1.6 after the word means, and then on line 1.7, deleting everything through the second comma.
Chair Schumacher? You're good with this?
Yes, I'd like to have that incorporated.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't know if that's correct. Through the second comma, I think it would only be through the first comma on that line, 1.7.
There's one comma there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative Baker. I didn't see that first comma, so you're right. Through the second comma after the number.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, while I have the floor, I'm just... House Research pointed out to me that to be consistent, there's an oral amendment to the bill that needs to go along with that, and I don't know, I don't think we're going to need do that now, but I just want to let you know that would be coming just to be consistent with this change.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to go right to hearing going back.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The oral amendment has passed, is adopted. Back to A1-1, as amended. Chair Schumacher?
I have nothing more to add on this.
Okay, is there any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members.
We're going to go to the bill. Representative Liebling, you have an oral amendment to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, if we're on the bill now, on line 4.16, House Research pointed out to me that we need to strike the language after the semicolon, or I should say between the semicolons on that line. The language that we're striking reads assessments on employers under the Affordable Care Act. So I would move that oral amendment to the bill.
Okay. Ms. Pinelli, will you tell us what that will do?
Madam Chair and members, this, I believe, would make the language in the bill consistent with the change that was just made to the A1-1 amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Pinelli. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The oral amendment prevails and is adopted. We have Amendment A2 before us. Does everyone have a copy? I believe it's Representative Keel's amendment. Representative Keel, do you move this amendment?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair.
Would you please explain the amendment to us?
A1 is, Amendment A2 is to add the nursing facility in Golden Valley. And I believe we have somebody that is in the audience that would like to explain that for us.
Please introduce yourself and tell us who you represent.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Matt Kinney. I'm the administrator of the Courage Kinney Transitional Rehab Program in Golden Valley. I was here, had the opportunity to testify with Dr. Street and Molly Colstead last week. As I mentioned last week, our program is on a fiscal cliff. Very concerned about the long-term sustainability of what we believe is a statewide asset. House File 316 does a lot for nursing homes across the state. unfortunately does not address the highly specialized nature of our facility. The A2 amendment adds House File 190 language that specifically names our facility for an operating rate exemption and allows us to close the funding gap that it currently exists.
Are there any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I certainly appreciate the difficult situation that this facility is in, but I just wanted to see if House Research could just tell us, just looking at the amendment itself, what subdivisions 50, 51, and 55 are that are being skipped, if this is, because it's the amendment says that the rate for the facility must be calculated without the application of subdivisions 50, 51, and 55. So I just wondered if we could know a little more precisely what those are before we vote on the amendment.
Ms. Pinelli?
Madam Chair and members, subdivision 50 lays out the determination of the total care-related limit. Subdivision 51 sets out the determination of other operating prices, and I believe subdivision 55 is being repealed. It is. So subdivision 55 is being repealed in the bill, but that subdivision has to do with the phase-in of the rebased operating payment rates.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Newton.
I'd like to ask Ms. Dinelli if we shouldn't then delete and 55 in the amendment.
Ms. Pinelli?
If subdivision 55 is being deleted.
Ms. Pinelli.
Madam Chair and members, yes, in order to be technically correct, we probably should change line 1.9 of the amendment. So it should read subdivisions 50 and 51.
We will just incorporate that amendment.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is being adopted. I have an amendment labeled
Madam Chair.
Yes, Chair.
If we could have the long-term care imperative, please come back up and explain the bill in more detail before we go on any further with amendments.
Sounds good.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seems like we're going so smoothly.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, and please tell us who you are for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota today, testifying on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative with my counterpart, Carrie Thurlow. As you've heard in the past, last presentation, you heard about the demographics and what's facing us as a state as we try to prepare for caring for seniors. Chairman Schumacher also outlined some of the challenges that have been expressed by our providers, as you heard last week. I think there's some key issues that we need to remind ourselves of as we look at what we're actually trying to solve or why are we doing this. First, Minnesotans, we're going to have more demand for services. Demographics indicate that we're going to have 60,000 people turning over 65. Older folks are going to outnumber kids. We all know those statistics, but what it means is we're going to have a more demand for senior services, and that as those people live longer, there will be more demand for services. We want to make sure that we provide quality services to those folks. We need more quality caregivers. Part of what you've heard already is the discussion of how do we compensate those caregivers in the form of insurance, for example. Carrie will go into more detail about what challenges our providers are facing as far as recruiting and retaining quality caregivers, but it's the second point at which we're trying to solve with this bill. Third point is that we need to support and fund the full continuum of care. We all know that nursing homes are not the only place that people get services, that in fact we want the continuum of care from in their home to assisted living or home and community-based services all the way through nursing homes. We need to continue to be mindful of that because we want to provide the right services in the right place at the right time. We need to reform our payment system, and our payment people, or as we refer to them affectionately, our data guys will come down and walk through kind of the nuts and bolts of it. But as you heard Chair Schumacher say, we currently don't really have a system. We have a rate on rate that's tied to something that was set 20, 25 years ago. This bill tries to take a full look at what it actually means to pay for the care for seniors. And as you walk through and consider this proposal, we just ask you to keep in mind these principles. We want to help seniors remain in a place they call home for as long as they can. We want to fully fund what we all believe is needed quality care for seniors. And we want to invest in caregiving as a long-term care profession. It's with those principles that we tried to design this payment proposal. And now I'll turn it over to Carrie to talk about more of the why we really need this proposal.
Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I really want to thank Representative Schumacher for carrying this bill. It represents a lot of work between the end of last session and to this point to really rethink the way that we approach paying for our older adult services. As we get closer and closer to the year 2020, which, by the way, is only 4 years away, which doesn't feel like a lot of time, that's the year that we'll have more more seniors than school children. We know we have to start thinking about how we approach our aging issues differently so that we're prepared for that, and we have to start this year. That's really what this bill represents. I know several providers were here last week and talked about their own personal workforce challenges, but let me put a statewide lens on it so that just to sort of reinforce kind of what you heard. We estimate that currently, just in nursing homes alone, just today, there are about 1,800 open positions that we can't fill. And that is largely due to the fact that we don't have a reimbursement system that allows us to pay our caregivers enough to recruit and retain. Our biggest position openings are certified nursing assistants, but we also struggle in recruiting LPNs, RNs, dietary aides, therapists, all of the people that are really needed to care for that growing senior population that will need care. We also struggle with staff turnover. I know you heard last week that it's hovering around 30%. I will tell you our own estimates say if you break that out by staff categories for CNAs statewide, turnover hovers around almost 50%. For dietary aides, that's about 45%. LPNs and RNs are at about 40%, and then LPNs are at about 35%. So there are certain job categories, while 30% turnover is bad, when you think about those that really deliver the care, those areas that we most need, 50% turnover for CNAs is simply unacceptable. When you think about providing the care that folks like the senior you met last week, Helen, really deserve. The big reason why we suffer with recruitment and retention, we'll just be very blunt, is because of the wage gap that exists. Now, I'm going to give you comparisons in healthcare settings, but keep in mind, as you heard last week, we compete also outside the healthcare arena. With sectors outside, but just in a healthcare arena, an RN working in a hospital versus a senior care setting, that's nursing homes or home care, makes almost $35,000 a year more in a hospital. That's not a real choice anymore. Even if that RN has sort of a mission to care for seniors, that's not a real economic choice if he or she can make $35,000 a year more in a hospital setting versus a long-term care setting. We're not creating a pipeline to get folks into the careers where we're going to have the most demand. A nursing assistant can make almost $12,000 a year more in a hospital setting than a long-term care setting. Again, if we are setting up pipelines to direct folks to the careers where we're going to need it, we need to address this wage gap, and this bill will do that. One of the biggest reasons, though, that we have this wage gap, people ask us, why do you have this wage gap? Why can't you get people into the settings to work? Why does this exist? Well, it is because, as Toby explained, we don't have a system that is designed to be responsive. Currently, we estimate that Minnesota, the gap between Medicaid reimbursement rates, that's the rates that you all set, and the allowable costs that are reimbursable, the gap between those two items is about $35 per resident per day. That's that gap. So because of rate equalization, that means the private pay gap is that large as well. And nursing homes are left sort of with their hands tied. I think you heard from Bruce Glanzer last week talking about how they're feeling very constrained. So we need to address and reform and actually put a system in place that's responsive so we can meet our staffing needs, so we can be responsive, and so we can provide the quality care that seniors like Helen really deserve. I heard a quote last week that growing old is sort of the gift of a life well lived. And we should make sure that Minnesota is not only a great place to raise a family, I personally am interested in that we're a great place to grow businesses, but we're a great place to grow old also. And that our seniors have access to the care that they need, the quality care they deserve in their communities when they need it. And so thank you, Representative Schumacher, for carrying this, and thank you, members of the committee, for your attention today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wished to testify? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and tell us who you represent.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, my name is Todd Bergstrom. I work with Care Providers in Minnesota. And my counterpart over to the right of me is Jeff Bostic with Leading Age Minnesota. And we both are kind of in charge of the research and data areas for both associations. And we like to kind of go over more of the detailed aspects of the proposal that's in front of you. So I believe everyone should have, we're going to reference kind of this handout. That's what we're going to walk through, or at least if we may reference it on occasion. I believe that was provided. Yes? Okay, so I'm going to give some general background and talk about a couple of things, and Jeff's going to go into more specifics into what the proposal before you actually does for nursing facility payment. So beginning around the conclusion of last legislative session, Jeff and I began meeting with the Department of Human Services to talk about what we could do or what we should do to try and fix what has become a system that frankly is just not responsive. And what I'll note is if you look in this handout and you look at the chart on page 3 at the bottom, you have a summary of what other states do. Minnesota, I think it was referenced by Carrie or Toby, does not have a payment system. We're noted under, I think there's another state, and I'm not sure which one, other, because we don't frankly have a way of setting rates year in and year out. You can see the vast majority of states have either a cost-based system, a cost with some sort of price component, or a price-based system and an annual way of basically setting those rates year in and year out. And so what we wanted to do when we sat down last summer was to start to figure out what is a good way we could go about putting a system in, a responsive system, as a way of paying nursing homes. And so the first few months actually was not actually about the details, but more about, well, what are the things we're trying to accomplish? And I'll just note, just so that you keep them in mind as we talk about it, there's four or five things that ultimately we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to preserve access throughout the continuum, and that by that I mean throughout the state, support nursing facilities and seniors wherever they may be, invest in recruitment and retention of caregivers, again, having a responsive system that covers the cost of care will allow us to do that. Reward quality care. Jeff's going to go into more specifics, but there is a very reform-minded part of this bill where the care-related payments are actually adjusted or according to a specific nursing home's quality. Finally, dignity and quality of life. I'll note that there's a placeholder for property payment. That's a separate component. It's actually, if you can believe it, a little bit more complicated than how we pay for the care-related part. But what that does is pay for the kind of the buildings, the rooms, and rent, if you will. And then finally, you'll note that ultimately what we want to do is get to something that's responsive, hopefully understandable, and ultimately allows for the cost of care to be covered or that's provided to seniors throughout Minnesota. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. He's going to talk about the specific parts of the operating payment changes.
Thanks, Todd, and thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Jeff Bosick with Leading Age Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, and I'm going to go through a little bit, without getting too detailed with you, a little bit of the process of how rates would be calculated under this new system that's in the bill that you have before you today, and how it differs from the process that we've used so far or for the last 20 years or so. The components that are listed on the handout, they're actually components to the current rates that are similar. They're basically just kind of locked in at the levels that they're in, and they increase if a COLA is provided. They kind of proportionally increase care-related, et cetera. One of the primary things our proposal does is, for years, facilities have been filing cost reports that show exactly how they spend money to provide care in terms of how much is nursing salaries, how much is other aspects of nursing, how much is within other departments. So this information is available to kind of show what the cost of care is, but it isn't used in any way to impact the rate that's paid by the Medicaid program. So that's one of the primary things that we're trying to accomplish here, is to get those more aligned. So on care-related pays for nursing, social services activities, and also the food is included as this part. Again, this comes off the cost report that each facility files, so it's the actual cost. And we're looking at paying the facilities within a limit, which I'm going to explain in a second. Their actual costs get converted directly into a rate here. The idea behind doing that in this area is that we want to have an incentive to invest in care-related. We want people to be able to respond to issues around the workforce, which you heard people talk about last week. We talked about a little bit this morning. The ability to change wages and benefits to be as competitive as possible to attract and retain employees is very important. And this is the primary portion of the rate where we would be able to do that. And we also believe it's an area where people would be able to influence their quality by making some investments. So we are looking at paying people their individual facility costs for care-related, but with a limit, so that there is some constraint on how high this portion of the rate could be. And one of the things that we came up with in our discussions with DHS was we were trying to find a way to integrate quality within the payment system. We have some quality incentive programs that we think are fairly successful. But they kind of sit outside of the actual rate system. So you have your rate, and then potentially you have a quality incentive payment on top of that. And we were looking at how do you use quality to influence in some way the rates that people are paid. So what we came up with is, if you want to, we wanted to apply a limit to costs. And so instead of just doing a straight limit saying you can't go over X dollars per day, we did an adjusted limit, so if you have a lower quality score, you get a lower limit, and if you have a higher quality score, you get a higher limit, so you essentially have earned a potential reward that more of your costs will be recognized in the rate. Other operating, we took a slightly different approach. Todd briefly mentioned cost versus price. Here we're using more of a price approach, which means looking across a group of facilities. We're calculating a price that's then applied to all facilities to cover dietary staff, housekeeping, laundry, utilities, administration. So the incentive in this area will be to be efficient, to be in line with what other facilities are doing, and to not, exceeding and the average cost here doesn't really pay off, because you're going to get paid whatever the price is. So there's an incentive to kind of stay within that price. The other thing about that I would say, though, is because we're calculating the price based on the costs off the cost report, so you're taking it across a group of facilities to calculate that price, it does adjust unlike the current system. So if you have a situation where staffing in these areas is getting more expensive because of competition for labor, if you have a particularly expensive situation with utilities because prices are spiking for electricity or gas, that will get reflected into the rates and won't be something that needs to be dealt with a proposal for a special rate increase. The two remaining components of the rate are smaller, so I won't spend as much time on it. The bulk of the rate is the care-related and other operating. External fixed, which is sometimes referred to as pass-throughs, is kind of a group of various things that either are out of control of the facility or that are not generally subject to not subject to limits or not subject to being part of care-related. The surcharge payment that people have to pay is here, any bed closure incentives they've gotten, license fees, the scholarship program is actually included here. Our proposal, which we talked about a little bit earlier today, would include health insurance costs here. And even with the amendment earlier today, it's still a significant piece to put health insurance costs in this portion of the rate where they'll be recognized and be paid so that investments in providing health insurance for employees, which is becoming a mandate for employers starting this year, those costs will be recognized in the payment. And on property, as Todd said, it's a complicated portion of the rate. It's a relatively small component of the rate that makes up only about 10% of the overall payment. But the computation of the actual payments is probably more complicated than what goes on with operating. So we're doing some continuing work on that and are planning to have an amendment later to this bill that would more clearly describe what the intent is in terms of changing property payments going forward. And unlike the rest of the bill, that we're expecting to take effect 2016 and going forward as opposed to with the rates starting in 2015. And there are a couple more things we wanted to talk about. I don't know if Todd wants to take over for a little while.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Jeff. So just so you'll note that previous systems we've used have used peer groups. And there's a couple of differences with this proposal than what you've seen in the past. First, in the past, we would have there was a difference between hospital attached and freestanding. So there are nursing facilities that are by definition attached to the hospital, and they used to be in a category that allowed kind of a different consideration of limits. Similarly, we used to have, and you have to go way back to when we actually used them, which is over 25 years ago, in statute there are what are called groups 1, 2, and 3 under Rule 50, also affectionately known as Deep Rural, Rural, and Metro, even though Metro went all the way up to International Falls. And so we are proposing to continue to use, if you look at the map here, a peer grouping based on the maroon and gold counties that you see there. The principle behind that is we did renewed our analysis of what the actual underlying wage costs are, to basically allow these groupings to set the ultimate limits that are used, as Jeff noted, on the care-related side as well as on the pricing side. So, and then if you turn to the next page, you can see where we've actually put some preliminary modeling numbers in and what implementing this system fully on October 1, 2015 would mean in terms of rate increases throughout the 367 nursing homes or so throughout the state. And you can see the average rate increase is about 25%. And I'll just note, because I think Carrie mentioned it, Jeff mentioned it, this is basically this underlying rate increase reflects the underfunded nature of the Medicaid system. I mean, that's primarily where this occurs from. It's not to say that this is what each year the increases would be under the system. That just basically, on the first year, reflects how underfunded nursing facilities have been for the last 25 years.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to make a statement, more or less, that I really do support the overall makeup of this bill. I know that for me, running a business, you have to be competitive with the marketplace. And I made the statement, I think, at a prior meeting, that we have dropped the ball on long-term care and nursing facilities. This is a very large one-time market rate adjustment, I feel. I think this is a good bill. It's got the controls on the high cost and high expense nursing facilities that limits those that are not as prudent as others, and I think it's a good overall bill. Seeing firsthand some of the payroll reports on local nursing facilities without seeing names, but seeing their positions and their rates, this is the right time and it is the right amount. So I just wanted to go on record to say I really do support this. I think they've done a really good job in looking at the overall bill and have the right parameters to make this work. So thank you.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier about property formulas that are too complicated to talk about. My background is in commercial real estate in New York City. So I just like some basic outline of what your thinking is and how that affects the bill and how the bill is going to look like when you have the actual formula.
Sure, I'd be happy to take a stab at that. Todd can add if he has some additional thoughts. Yeah, it could be an hour-long conversation. So to try and boil it down, right now our property system essentially will pay people, will give increases in the property rate based on approval for a project and then the cost of that project, so the debt service that's tied to it, and there's also a payment for any equity that you put into it. So the idea is that it will cover the cost of doing a project. We are looking at kind of moving away from that system into an alternative that potentially would look at the value of the building just in general and then say, and then vary those payments based on things like how new the building is, how well it's been kept up, how much space per resident you're providing, because there's a lot of variation in terms of size of buildings that have been developed over the years. So we want to preserve an incentive to invest in the in newer and nicer environments, but with the understanding that we've invested money in properties over the years, so we have to look at those existing rates versus what the new rates would do, and make sure you're not disadvantaging anyone or advantaging people unnecessarily. I don't know if there's anything else you.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher. I think one of the underlying issues is if you transition to a new operating payment system, the way we're doing property right now is not aligned with the new operating payment system. And so, and the present way we do things, Jeff, he alluded to part of it. There's like three people in Minnesota who understand it, and they're slowly retiring. And it's not him and I. So. So
hope
there's
a place before they retire.
So what we hope to do is figure out a way that rewards facilities that keep their building up, that aligns so that those costs don't drift over into the operating side, that they are kept within keeping the building up, and reward kind of the financial upkeep or depreciation of a building.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And don't get me wrong, I think this is a good bill overall, and it's something that we've invested in last biennium. But getting back to the buildings, is there a difference between the way nonprofit, government, and for-profit, maybe even real estate trusts are treated as far as property calculations now, and you're going to take that into account in the new formula?
Mr. Bergstrom? I'm not sure who's looking they want to answer it.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, the present system really is kind of, for lack of a word, kind of agnostic about a lot of issues. If the question is how you move forward and are there policy issues we need to consider again, I think that's all that's on the table. Because I think that's a very, right now what we have and how we pay for capital or rent or property doesn't make a lot of sense. So if there are ideas or better ways to align with how we pay for care, as how we pay for the building,
think we're open to that.
Mr. Lilly, or Representative Lilly? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is a question for the author or the testifiers, but in your proposal here, you're talking about other operating rates, and then the formulas will be different for different work groups and sort of thing. And I you know, part of my later amendment is the, you know, the about the workforce and the quality, and, you know, they're all, I guess, all workers, I think, are important. So somehow you're spinning off, you know, different, like, cleaners and laundry folks, and I just don't understand your logic. And I guess it concerns me a little bit, because it is one area where you're not really, your reimbursement's going to be different. So I think you're going to, there's also, there might be a incentive, conceivably, to drive costs down in these areas. And part of what I think is important, you know, for the folks is, you know, that they're getting good food and that the rooms are clean and that, you know, and so you need those folks as well. I mean, it's part of the whole package of quality care. So I don't know how you're, you know, you're using the word quality a lot, and so I don't know if you really mean it, but to me, quality would, you know, I don't know if you travel. I travel quite a bit, and if you go to a hotel and if the room isn't clean, if the, you know, the food isn't good, or, you know, so I kind of translate that into the same thing as a, you know, for seniors, are you gonna drive down costs in this area? And I would question that you're gonna be able to achieve quality. And so I just wanna ask what you're kind of thinking.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a fair question. So I would point out two things about the quality part. So your question about, so on the incentive to provide services that are not superior or above standard, the innovative part about this is we have this quality performance index that comes from the Minnesota State Report Card that DHS and the Department of Health have put together. And 40% of that is the annual customer satisfaction survey that is performed by Vital Research in-person customer satisfaction surveys. I think we're one of the few states who actually goes out and engages in this. And there's 12 domains, and housekeeping, food, I don't know what they all are, but all of those are captured. So, and where that relates back to is if you don't perform well on that, your limit on your care-related side will, in fact, be less. So there's a strong incentive to not abandon services, housekeeping, food, whatever they may be. The other point, and this is more just philosophical, I guess, there are other ways to do this. You can do a cost-based approach to other operating. That usually goes along with an efficiency incentive. Other states have done that. I think our main point would be is other states have engaged in other ways of doing it. We're just looking for a way that's better than what we've been doing in Minnesota.
Right. And I guess the one thing I would add quickly, if I could, is that you know, the 105% payment for, you know, the 105% of your peer group average for other operating, I haven't looked at exactly what that is. We could, but it's a substantial, kind of like with care-related, you know, you're talking about, you know, a system that increases payments by roughly 25% on average. So there's a substantial investment built into this in those dietary, laundry, and housekeeping departments, because they've been underfunded as well as everything else. So just because the structure of the payment is a price and there's an incentive to stay within that price, there's still a, you know, a catch-up factor built in that would hopefully, you know, lead to improvements in those areas as well.
Representative Lilly.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Schumacher. I was afraid when Representative Baker started talking that he was going to ask for you to retire. You know, after I heard about, you know, I read a lot of outstate papers, and they were really, you know, questioning what we had. You know, how did you phrase it? As a freshman, I'm embarrassed or whatever for all. Right. Anyways, I don't know if you know how the chair voted on some of that stuff, but we, you know, in the last couple of years, we started funding again. So, substantially, and there's going to be another, you know, so just last year we raised it after you folks had flatlined it, quite honestly, and then I think there's another one coming this fall, another raise. So I'm wondering if the testifiers can, I mean, what's happening to that money? I mean, it sounds like that money, what are you doing with it? I mean, is it, you know, so we did, I mean, is that money being factored in? Is it being put to use, or do I have to agree with, you know, the other side that flatlined it? You know, or, you know, are we, you know, because we believed by when we were funding it, you know, we bought into the idea. I think they did some stuff with your, you know, we're talking about facilities. They did some stuff on the, you know, that Representative Rosenthal was bringing up with the, you know, the building expenses, and I think you guys curtailed some of the payback on some of the building costs. So, you know, we restored some of those cuts. What's being done? What's happening with that money that we did fund in the last couple, you know, or the last session, certainly?
Mr. Bergstrom? Mr. Bostic, I'm not really sure. You guys are looking at each other like...
Madam Chair, Representative, this goes into a much longer discussion, because I would broaden it beyond just the last few years and go back over the last 15 or 20. I think one of our central issues is there's been no predictability to what will occur year in, year out for nursing homes. So, but to your question, there was a 5% increase on average, I should say, on September 1st, 2013, and that was primarily dedicated to staff wages and benefits. But that was, I don't know how many months ago that was, and so that went in. Last year, there was a small... it's a three-year phase-in, and it's frankly, I don't know how much money it is when it's all said and done. Rate increases that are basically to help meet the compliance to the changes in the minimum wage statute. Again, we're not, I don't know if there's any estimates of what that actually amounted to, and it's phased in over 3 years, so it's difficult to say what that'll be. And then, as you know, there is a 2.4% rate increase that, so there was not a rate increase generally across the board this previous October. There is one on the books that, again, has, I think, it has the same language in terms of what's dedicated to our staff.
Yeah.
Mr. Bostic.
Yeah. Just quickly to kind of talk about, Todd talked about the last 25 years. In broad terms, you know, rate increases have not kept up with costs. So there was a 5% in 2013. Before that, there was a four-year freeze. Before that, rate increases were relatively small, and people have, you know, made efforts to, you know, constrain costs as much as they can and where they can, and that's part of what's contributing to the workforce crisis. But the reality right now is that we have a substantial gap between, if you look at what the cost is and you look at what the rates are, there's a substantial difference, and that's, you know, one of the big things that we're trying to, you know, fix here with this proposal. And so the 5% and various other rate increases are part of that rate that we're comparing against the current cost. So that money has been spent and then some.
Just Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, and I appreciate it, and I think we'd argue, and I think there's merit to what you're saying, that we have not, as a body, over time. And I think clearly we understand that the need is great statewide, and care about that. I was giving Representative Baker a little freshman hazing, because I happen to like Joe, Representative Schumacher, and I want him to stick around, even though he didn't vote for that stuff. But we're in a tough business, and I get it, but I'm teasing you a little bit. But we understand it, and we want to fund this statewide and continue. The reality is we're measured on how we vote, and we passed it the last couple of years, and we, you know, I'm going to, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to vote for this. I'm a co-author and support it, but I think, you know, you keep focusing on workers, you know, so that's later my amendment, but, you know, there's, I'm glad you're taking it on, but it's, you know, it's complicated. It's, so hopefully Representative Baker's listening.
Representative Miller.
No.
No? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it sounds like the testifiers are kind of complaining about the fact that some of those wages were encumbered, or that the funding that we added had to go to the workers. And I thought I understood that one of the chief complaints of the nursing homes was that they couldn't retain staff. So I don't think that would be something to complain about. But just to build a little bit on what Representative Lilly was talking about, I understood that there was another 3.2% rate increase that's supposed to go into effect on October of this year. So there is more money coming in to the system. And I think his question, which I didn't really hear an answer to, is sort of how that's going to impact this as we look to add another $200 million, which I think is about what this bill does over the biennium. So the DFL in the last biennium added, I think, about $60.5 million to nursing home funding. What Representative Lilly was talking about, just to be really clear for anybody who's watching on the TV, I don't know if we're on TV. Okay, not. Okay, well then. Maybe I don't have to say it. Maybe everybody in the room already knows. But the GOP has voted to cut senior services. And when the GOP was in charge, there was a huge cut to senior services, which was about almost $200 million, if I have the number right. And so now we're, you know, and as Representative Lilly said, we know that sometimes we're in deficit situations. Now we have what looks to be a little bit of money. But, you know, when we hear Representative Baker, who's a freshman, talking about he's embarrassed, he should be embarrassed by his own party on this issue. That's I think, what we want to make really clear here, because the DFL has worked to improve funding to nursing homes. And we have done so. And if you look at the chart that was given to us by the long-term care imperative about nursing home rate increases and decreases, in 2013, it shows the 5% after a big gap. And so I just want to lay that out there. But the question that I want to ask is and I think we all here around this table obviously are concerned about the issue. I've always been very glad that Representative Schumacher is really into this issue. That's important because obviously it's very complicated. And I'm glad that now, instead of voting to cut senior services, which he did do, that he's moving this forward. That's a really positive, wonderful thing. I'm a little concerned that we don't have the runs, that we don't get to see before we vote on this what this does to the nursing homes in our own districts. Those of you who are freshmen, when we have bills that impact things financially, like, for example, school systems or local government aid where it impacts differently across the state, we usually have spreadsheets that show us what it will do in our own districts before we vote on this. Now, we're not in the finance committee. I get that. I've been told that long-term care imperative is going to produce that later on. But I'm wondering why we don't have it now, because this is obviously something that has been in the works for a while. And I'm just a little concerned, because this is all very complicated stuff. We've all been hearing how complicated it is. And I would venture to guess that not one of us around this table, with the exception of Ms. Pugnelli, I'm sure, not one of us really understand this stuff, because it's really complicated. Even Representative Schumacher, this is hard. So we're voting on something that we don't know how it's impacting our own nursing homes. And we've got the two peer groups, which means some are going to do better than others. And we're a little bit blind. So I'd like to know why the long-term care imperative has not come forward with this before we had the first hearing on the bill.
Chair Schumacher.
Well, I was to Representative Liebling's point on that, it just because it isn't a finance committee is... It was the point I was going to make about why we don't have the runs, and why we're just looking at this as a group, as a policy, and as the different groups and how it affects overall. That's the only point I had, and she made that point as she was speaking. So.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Certainly this isn't a criticism of you, but the long-term care imperative has brought this forward. They're the people with the number crunchers and the resources to do this, and they've obviously thought this through long and hard. And even though we're not in a finance committee, members are going to take a vote on something that they really don't know whether it helps their district or perhaps disadvantages their district compared to others. And, you know, I could understand that I know it takes some time to get those runs and all that, but I haven't heard why, with all the work that's gone into this, why we don't have that up front. And so I'd kind of like to understand that, and I'd like to know when we're going to have that, because I think all the members are going to really want to know what that does, you know, before we go very much further here.
Mr. Bostic?
Yes, thanks. Responding on behalf of the imperative, we've been working with the department on these projections that are in the handout here. You know, obviously we've done calculations for individual facilities. We're still updating those. So we'll be updating them further based on the based on the amendment today, and the department, I believe, has been requested to do an official fiscal note, and so we're planning on timing the fiscal note on the bill with the release of the official runs for facilities by district. So it's not going to be much longer before those numbers are released to everyone.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A minute ago, you said that the last couple raises primarily went to state to the employees. Could you give me a percentage?
I believe, without having the statute in front of me, I think the standard practice on encumbrance has been that 75% is required to go to wage increases and benefits. Does that sound?
Representative Considine.
Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, you know, we could keep going back and forth on every committee we're on, rehashing the past. And, you know, if I was that type of person, I could remind people that Democrats, when they were in control the last 2 years, raised over $2 billion worth of taxes, and the one committee that was in their budget to cut was Health and Human Services. But since I'm not that type of person, I am going to say that I am excited that the long-term care imperative has brought forward this bill, and I think we can all agree that you know, nursing homes are extremely valuable in our districts. In some of our rural towns, the nursing home is the largest employer that we have. And speaking to the workers, administrators, granted we gave some increases in the past couple of years, but when you talk to the workers themselves, that increase amounted to pennies on the dollar. Hardly anything. It was just a little something to put a to make them feel like they were appreciated, but it did nothing at all to raise their income levels at their house. And I think going forward, that's what we need to think about, is how are we going to move this industry forward? How are we going to maintain quality workers? How are we going to maintain a quality of life for our senior citizens? Going over the governor's budget, I was extremely disappointed to see that he did not give anything toward long-term care. But anyway, we are going to see this bill move forward. Representative Liebling, I believe that you are also on Health and Human Services with me. And so we're going to have these conversations continue throughout the course. And I just hope that we can all, you know, hold hands, get along, and do what's right for our senior citizens.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on the point about knowing how things are going to affect our district. The cost basis is relative to the median. I know that that's current law, that's not changed. But because that's on a numbers of facility basis and not a per resident basis, could you tell me if you have some feel for how these changes will affect large facilities versus small facilities, if there's going to be a difference in how they fare under the new system compared to each other?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, Representative, we've not done that specific analysis, but I would guess it there's probably no, as a percent increase, I would guess that there's no difference in terms of how large and small facilities are accounted for under the system.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would really like to see some kind of breakdown that way, because there are quite a few things that are built into this cost basis that I would expect would vary quite a lot between large facilities and small facilities. I'd love to see some kind of breakdown on what our relative costs are in different kinds of facilities. And, you know, we have things like administrative costs rolled into this. Those are going to differ quite a bit. Property costs are going to differ quite a bit. Even things like heating and other services are going to differ quite a bit between large and small facilities. And in my district in particular, I happen to have quite a large facility and fewer of the small ones, and I would really like to know how this is going to change relative between the two classes.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will include that in our, as we proceed to do that sort of analysis.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Chair Schumacher. Although this is a policy committee, the finances are terribly important for all of us on both sides of the aisle. And I know in testifying before other committees when I brought bills forward, even though they may be a policy committee like an education policy committee, one of the questions always was how much is this going to cost? And even though the policy committee isn't voting on the cost, in order for representatives to vote for their district and to know what they are voting for, I think that we should know on every bill that comes forward in this committee what the cost is and what the impact is on our local communities. And so I hesitate to suggest that you might want to table this until we have that. I don't know what the time frame is for bringing this to the Health and Human Services Committee, but I would hope you would consider that, and as we move forward to make sure that we know the costs of everything that we're voting on, because even though it is policy, we are voting and we're trying to move it forward. So, thank you.
Chair Schumacher, do you want to make a comment? Thanks. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to respond to Representative Franson. You know, they say that those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So, you know, I've heard this in other committees. It seems to be a theme this year. Let's just forget about what we did when we were in charge. But that laid the groundwork for where we are now. And as far as all the taxes we raised, you know, this seems to be the problem that the GOP gets into. You want to spend the money, but you don't want to raise it. The reason that we have funds now that we can think about putting more into senior services or anything else is because we did raise the taxes to pay for a lot of things that Minnesotans were very happy with, including, by the way, lots of things that went to rural Minnesota. So, you know, if you don't like the taxes, don't spend the money. But, I don't think we're going to really, you know, hopefully we are going to move forward. There are a lot of great things we are going to do together, and you know, you and I actually agree on a lot of things, and we work together really well on a lot of things. And we all know, just for the freshmen, you know, this is a legislature. It's a very political body. But it's certainly not personal, right? I mean, I enjoy working with Representative Franson, and I certainly enjoy working with Representative Schumacher. But you guys did vote against the funding that you're now supporting. And, you know, I don't know why you did that. I'm glad that you now want to move forward and support it, but we can't forget the past, because then we may very well be condemned to repeating it.
Now that we've gone way off topic, I'd like to continue on, and I have an amendment labeled A3. Who is offering this?
I am, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly, do you want to move the amendment A3?
Yes, I'd like to move it and ask for a roll call, please.
Representative Lilly moves Amendment A3. Does everyone have the amendment? Is there any discussion? Representative Lilly, will you please explain the amendment?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Schumacher, and members. We've heard a lot about folks today and the workers, and I was really touched by Helen. I don't know if you've had a chance to meet Helen. I watched this video over and over. The caregivers was part of their deal, but I kind of fell in love with Helen. So you guys probably all would too if you get an opportunity to watch it. But it's about everybody's kind of said it, And I wish Representative Franson would have just said what she said in the middle there, part of it, about the workers. And my intent is that that we continue with the goals and reforms that the chair is seeking, but that that this makes it down to employees, the funding increase. And I think it's, I don't know the number, but I'm guessing it's, you know, a couple $100 million or more, or we don't really know, but clearly the need is there. And we talk about retention, and I was sincere about the, you know, all the workers in the situation, because when you think about it, when you're in that, you know, some of these folks, you know, I question of how they can audit some of the quality, you know, because there's some memory care people. I mean, they're not going to be able to fill out a form that said, oh, you know, my room was clean or not. You know, I just question of how. So I just really am a firm believer it's best for all of us. And as I'm probably the oldest one here of us, except for maybe this guy. No, I don't know. But, you know, I'm part of that baby boom that's coming. And we want to make sure that, you know, that the workers are there. And I really believe that you need to treat them well. Part of that's the health care package you're talking about. But also to, you know, it comes down to pay, which Representative Franson, I thought, so accurately stated. You know, we are, and then the testifiers earlier said, we are motivated by, you know, money. And these decisions of where you're going to work, you know, are you going to work at the Home Depot? They talked about it earlier, and I think this amendment captures some of that, because, you know, I really think, I mean, think about it. If you're the customer, if you're Helen, you know, and you're in that room, you're being provided these services, do you want that person to stay there long term? I mean, think about it. I mean, there would be cost savings for these. You know, we continually hear about run government like a business. Well, the better you pay folks, the less turnover there's going to be. And think about it. They're going to know. I mean, I don't know about you, but there's certain foods I don't like. And maybe there's a food that Helen doesn't like. But if you have a new staff every week, maybe in the kitchen or whatever, and she may not like broccoli, you know, like me. But they're going to know that. You know, and maybe she, you know, so it's, I think, you know, especially as we look at, you know, hiring these folks and maintaining them, I think the amendment kind of captures that. I know your bill's, you know, being shaped as it goes forward. You've offered, you actually redid the first bill, then you've had a couple amendments, and I'm sure you're not done. It sounds like there's another amendment coming, and so it's offered in that spirit of moving the bill forward. And I think everybody around the table has talked about the value of the workers, and you know, I think that's really what it's about. I mean, just offering quality care to the seniors all over Minnesota and ensuring that. So, and that's, it's offered in that spirit. So, thank you. I'd stand for questions.
We have a testifier, Louise Duffy. Welcome to the committee, and could you please tell us who you are and who you represent?
Thank you, Chairman Schumacher. Members of the committee, good morning. My name is Louise Duffy, and I am a certified nursing assistant at Texas Terrace Care Center. It is a nursing home in St. Louis Park. I've worked there for several years, 24 years to be exact. I've worked in nursing homes for the better part of my career. In fact, I'm here after working night shift last night. I want to start by thanking the chair for bringing forward a bill to increase funding significantly for nursing homes. In addition, I think all stakeholders agree that the rate structure itself needs to be updated to better reflect current actual costs. But the current system did have one major advantage. When there was a rate increase, workers could be assured that they would get their fair share of the new money. Just because the state provides a nursing home with more money That does not mean all workers get a raise. For example, while the press often described the rate increase passed in 2012 as a 5% raise for nursing home workers, it is the employers who got the additional money. And we know that the rate increase alone does not mean workers got a 5% pay increase. I had to explain to my coworkers that the 5% rate increase had to cover more than just labor costs, and that just because the home got a higher rate, that by itself did not raise our pay. When they found out that the pay increase they heard about on radio and TV, the 5%, did not mean that they thought it meant what really it meant, their reaction often turned to disappointment and frustration. That is why the encumbrance and the facility language was so important. That is why legislatures first created the language and why they included it in all the recent across-the-board rate increases. I could explain to my coworkers that the legislature was on our side. I could say that the legislature required that nursing homes spend a certain percentage of the 5% increase on workers. At my facility, the language meant workers knew we could sit down with our employer and decide together how to best spend the new money. Even more than just the pay increase, workers feel truly valued when you make sure they receive a fair share of the nursing home funding. Even more than just money, they want to have a voice in how the new revenue is spent. Instead of feeling disappointed and frustrated when my coworkers learned that the legislature had encumbered the new money, they felt valued. They felt empowered. I think this was a valuable part of the current system, and for that reason, I encourage you to vote yes, please, on this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the A3 amendment? Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on how important this amendment is, whether you're talking to the managers of the facilities, whether you're talking to the residents or the workers themselves, everybody agrees that the compensation for the healthcare workers is not there. So I think this is an incredible step forward.
Chair Schumacher?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and Representative Lilly. I really appreciate you bringing this forward. I know it's very sincere and comes from exactly what we talked about, those our first couple interactions about this and what you're trying to do here. I was wondering if we could, if I could ask for Bob Held from DHS to come up and just kind of explain the process if he's in the room. I haven't bothered to turn my chair around to see if he is here today, but just to kind of give comment and explain what this at this level and what this would do as it's written.
Certainly. Could you please tell us who you are and who you represent?
Madam Chair, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services, and I've been sitting there hoping I would get asked a question about this matter. The 2013, September 1st, 5% increase did have an encumbrance in it. There was earlier testimony that 75% was encumbered. That was pretty close to being accurate. My computation is it's about 56 or 57% of it that was in fact encumbered. That increase was an average of 5%. It consisted of a 3.75% general rate increase. That was the same percentage for all facilities of their operating payment rate, and an average quality add-on of 1.25%, 3/4 of the total amount. The quality add-on was not encumbered at all. 3/4 of the 3.75 was encumbered. So I was doing a little math in my head on the way from over there to over here, and I think that 3/4 of 3/4 is about 56%. So that's how much was encumbered. There was an encumbrance. I would also note that there was reporting that was done about that all nursing homes were going to get 5%, and it didn't very accurately reflect the reality that there was an average of 5%, which means some were going to get more because they had high quality scores and got much higher quality add-ons, up to about 3.2%, and some got less than the 1.25% average quality add-on. So there was an encumbrance. It wasn't 100%. There's never been 100% encumbrance. We have had encumbrances since 1998 on increases that have been allowed. They've never been 100% like this. There are other costs that the nursing homes have. And I want to be clear that I'm not speaking either in favor of having an encumbrance or in opposition to it. What I would note, however, is that under the rules of the 9113 encumbrance, approximately 70% of the encumbered money did go to wages. The encumbrance also allows for the money to be used for costs that are associated with wages, like, you know, if you give somebody a dollar increase, the employer is going to have an increase in their Social Security and Medicare taxes and so forth, unemployment, workers' comp. A lot of these costs are associated with a wage increase and go hand in hand with it. It also allowed for costs related to increases in benefits other than those associated costs, and it allowed for some consideration subject to the commissioner's approval of other fringe benefits or workforce needs, such as training and recruitment. Did I answer the question, Madam Chair? You know, somebody put a quarter in.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I believe he answered the question, but I'm not really sure I understood the answer. So if somebody was making $10 an hour, they roughly got a quarter raise. 5% would be 50 cents. So they roughly got a quarter. So they went from 10 to 10 and a quarter?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Considine, the math gets a little bit trickier than that, because for an average nursing home, between 70 and 75% of their costs are compensation related, related to compensating the workers in that facility. They also have other costs, operating costs, related to things like utilities and supplies and consultants and trash removal and raw food. And so if you were to say that 100% of the new money should go to wages, then you'd be saying we're not going to recognize any increases in these other costs. And I'm not sure you want to do that. I guess you have to decide that. But of the so let's say there was a facility did get the 5%, and they wanted to proportionately apply that money to wage increases, and you had a 75% encumbrance, it would probably accomplish about that they would in fact get a 5% increase. But then it wasn't there wasn't a proportionate relationship between the portion of costs that are wage related and the portion that was encumbered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Considine.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Let's make it real easy. On somebody that was making $10 an hour, what is your best guess as to what they got as a raise?
Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Considine, my best guess is it'd be between 35 and 50 cents. I'd like to narrow that down for you, but I can't do that right now.
Goodness. Thank you.
Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, thank you. And as someone who was the author of both the nursing home bill and the home health care bill, what I found in talking with care providers after we had passed the bill, is that we weren't specific in terms of encumbrance, so that in some cases there was a 50-cent increase. In others, they may be a 5% or 5-cent increase, because we didn't indicate that it had to be spread evenly across the board. And so, some healthcare workers, in whether they're nursing homes and home healthcare, receive very little, if any, increase, and others received more than a 5% increase. And that was left up to the home care providers and how they negotiated, if they did negotiate, with their employees.
Mr. Held, do you have any comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, that's absolutely correct. There was not. There have been earlier encumbrances that specified that all eligible workers would get a wage increase in an equal percentage amount. There may have been one or two encumbrances, because we've been doing this for about 17 years now, that talked about an equal dollar amount increase. This one did not address that issue at all. And I understood that to mean that the legislature intended to give the facilities flexibility to, they still had to use the same amount of money, but they would have to give bigger, they could give bigger increases where they felt the labor market demanded that, and smaller where it didn't, if they saw differences, and they could certainly do an equal dollar or percentage amount if they chose to do that.
Representative Newton?
Madam Chair, yes, I agree. That wasn't necessarily the intent of the legislation, but that's how it worked out. So.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, can you address the language in this bill with regard to what we're doing in House File 316, the language in the amendment? How will it affect the bill?
Well, what this language will do is it will say that each facility has to make an application to the Department of Human Services to get the money that this bill otherwise allows. That they have to tell us how they're going to use that new money for the purposes specified in here, and those are the purposes of providing wage and salary increases, of paying the associated costs of employers' health insurance, dental, and so on, and then other benefits subject to the commissioner. It does not include that workforce needs piece. That this is money that applies to all employees in the facility, with certain exceptions, those being the administrator, central office staff, and persons working in the facility under a management contract. That there's an application process, there's timelines associated with that application process. The contents of an application are specified, and by the way, what we do to administer this is we put a template on our website that facilities can just fill in the blanks, and it makes it a lot easier for them to do an application and for us to promptly review it and approve it. We have to ensure that the costs, that the encumbered money is being used in accordance with those purposes and for those allowed people. They have to post the approved application so all of their employees can see it. They have to have a process whereby employees who believe that it's not being followed have a way of challenging it through the facility and ultimately through the Commissioner of Human Services. It also specifies that where there's an exclusive bargaining agent, in other words a union, that the commissioner cannot approve the application without a letter of support or a letter of approval from that union to the commissioner, that that union support only applies where at least 10% of the employees are in a union, and that's pretty much what it covers.
Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So this weekend, probably like most of our members, somewhere along the route, we have spent time speaking to nursing homes, and I have been visiting with them quite a bit and had the opportunity this last weekend. I sat down with my nursing staff to begin with, and they showed me something we can't do anything about at this level, a federal form that takes my RNs 8 hours to fill out every time there's an incident with a patient. That's what they told me it will take them to do. So then some of the residents came to me and said they were frustrated because sometimes there wasn't continuous steady care in their nursing staff, partly because the aides are turning over a lot. And we have an employee issue just in northwestern Minnesota to begin with. I mean, we physically don't have bodies to work. But then I find an RN is spending 8 hours doing forms when she could be guiding aides in staff, you know, in technique and what they're doing with patients. So there's already all of that time frame, and I know administrators do these things, but I'm going to address rural because that's what I know best. But this is going to create another pile of paperwork in addition to what they already do, is what this amendment will do. Is that my understanding?
Mr. Hill?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, I'm not sure what federal form takes 8 hours to complete related to an incident that would take place. Two things come to mind. One would be the MDS form that I talked about a week or two ago, which is the assessment. And we do often hear concerns about the time it takes to complete assessments. And when I hear that, I tend to wonder how you would take care of people if you didn't assess their needs. But you talked about an incident, and so that makes me think maybe you're talking about an accident report form. I don't know how that could possibly take 8 hours, and I don't think it's federally imposed. So you then went on and talked about this encumbrance requirement. I believe it's generally the administrator or a bookkeeper who completes this encumbrance thing. I've never heard of it being rolling down to the nurse on the floor who should be taking care of people and doing an administrative task like that.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we probably need to move on, but I, in some of my rural communities, my director of nursing is doing paperwork, is doing evening shifts to fill in, to just keep their facility above water, open to be able to provide for their constituents, their clients. You're right, it is an assessment for when a patient or when a client moves into the nursing home. And then if there is an incident, they have to fill it out again. So let's just say, for sake of argument, I have an aunt in the nursing home. I move her in there. There's an assessment done. In another month, there's another assessment done, because that's what is required. And then after that, I believe it's a 90-day assessment, and that form is filled out every time for every patient that's there. And I realize that nurses are doing that assessment, not necessarily doing the financial issues here, or, you know, the financial paperwork. But I have a lot of directors and nurses that are holding back tears, and they're telling me how they're going to function. And so my concern is, with this amendment, that we are going to put more burden on already stressed out staff within our nursing homes and our care centers. And I watch, you know, my aunt happens to not talk very little. She talks once in a while, and she's dementia. But a lot of the conversation about her assessment is also done through family. When we talk about taking care of her room, addressing how the care in the room is, the cleanliness, the, her care, her food quality, all of those things are done through multiple people and done very well. I have no complaints at all. They're very good about responding when I need response. And but I think about some of the incidences that have happened that they, you know, there's an issue that happens. She has skin breakdowns, and we have to call the doctor in, and we fill those forms out again. She does. The nurse does. The director of nursing does. But we're putting high demand on our care centers, and I guess that's my ultimate point here. And we should make sure they're giving good care. That's absolutely the case. I say the best care for a relative is having family stop by often and at odd times. And I actually was an aide at one point, long before we were required to be certified. So it tells you it's been a while. So anyway, and I thank you for your description. I appreciate that.
Mr. Held, do you have a very brief comment?
I had no further comment.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the amendment, I had opportunity to talk to the chair, Chair Schumacher, and this is not a perfect deal because there are some costs related to the employees that I'm probably, you know, not probably should be less than maybe 100%. So maybe it should be reduced. And so we don't know the sweet exact number. And he's offered to maybe just sit down a couple minutes to, as a bipartisanly and work together on this. And then so I'm going to withdraw my amendment at this time, and then in the agreement that we're going to continue to work on it and discuss it. And then one thing that I would hope that the folks from they're out there working for Helen, that they the caregivers, that they do the runs, because that I think it, you know, and I think just to be totally honest, it's going to affect everybody's district different, and I just would be curious to see. And I know this isn't a finance committee, but I think it's just would be fair. So, with that, I mean, my amendment's withdrawn this time.
Chair Schumacher,
I thank Representative Lilly for withdrawing the amendment. I think that there is some common ground that we can find with the amendment to make sure that it gets in a form that is passable and can be signed into law in the future. So because we still want to work on that, I am going to lay the bill over in committee, and we'll bring it back again.
Okay. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
It's okay.